before he comes and speaks to us. Reed Swindle is known by most, I think everybody here. I believe he spoke at CYC last year, and several of our kids mentioned how much they enjoyed that. And so we started coming up with ideas of who we wanted to speak, and they said, that guy that spoke at CYC, we heard him, we really liked him. And I said, okay, you guys hear like 50 people at CYC. You're going to have to narrow it down to that one guy. And they said, Reed. I said, oh, okay. All right, I know Reed, and I know he does an awesome job. So the quickest I could, I sent a Facebook message and just begged him. I said, I know, you know, Saturday and December is probably not the best time in the world to try to get you to come to Athens, Alabama, but if there's any way possible. And he was gracious enough to kind of rework some things in his schedule to be here. He is the preacher at the Foot Street Church of Christ in Corinth, Mississippi. Been there for 2 years. But he was in youth work for 15 years before that. And so if there's anybody I trust to put in front of you, these two men tonight are definitely at the top of that list. And so after this song, I'll turn things over to Reed.
I was in college at Freed Hardeman. And they had invited us to come speak at a youth rally up in Banner Elk, North Carolina. Banner Elk, North Carolina is known for its ski slopes. I never skied before, but they told us when we came up early we could ski. And I'm not the most coordinated guy in the world, but I thought I'd give it a try. And so we went up there. There were several of us loaded up in Freed Hardeman vans, and we took off and went that direction. We got up there. It was beautiful. The church building, the Banner Elk Church of Christ, sits right at the base of this mountain. You can stand and look at the church building, and the ski slope just goes straight up behind it. And we had gone, and we spent all day Friday skiing. Friday night, we had our youth rally on Saturday, and we had a blast skiing. We had a lot of fun. But we were thinking that night, we got to thinking on, actually it was Friday night, we were sitting around talking about how much fun it would be if we could sled down that mountain. Now, skiing down, it's one thing, but sledding down, it's something totally different. You know, skiing is what you're supposed to do. Sledding is not what you're supposed to do. As a matter of fact, I think it was illegal to do that. We weren't really concerned about that. As a matter of fact, we didn't ask if it was legal or if it wasn't, but we decided that we were going to sled down this mountain. And the guy that we were staying with owned a ski shop, and he had these sleds. And so we borrowed his sleds. They were about this wide, and they were probably about, I don't know, 2.5-3 feet long, just plastic sleds. They were deep. They weren't the kind with blades. They were just kind of a plastic tub, just small tub. And so we decided we tied them to our arms. Because we didn't want to get, you know, fall off the things and lose the sleds going down the mountain, because we're talking about 3/4 of a mile, okay, down the hill. And so we took a van and parked it at the bottom of the ski slope at about 12 o'clock in the morning, and we drove the other van all the way up to where these condos at the top of the mountain. We left that van there, and we went through and got out to what was called the Black Diamond. If you've ever been skiing, the Black Diamond is the part you don't go on if you're me. You know, I mean, Lonnie Jones may have made snowboard down that. Reed Swindle could barely stand up there. And so we get out on top of this Black Diamond. And what has happened is during the day, everybody, the sun's come out, and it's kind of melted the snow. Everybody's been skiing on all day. It's packed it down. Then the temperatures have dropped. And now this slush has turned into ice, and they're pouring new powder on top of that. So you got a layer of ice with a layer of snow on top of it, and it was slick. And so we're standing there, and they had some lights on, but really all you could do is look kind of out about, you can see about 75 yards of light, and then it just dropped down into this black abyss. We had no idea really what was down there, because none of us had been skiing that day up that high. We knew nothing about that, you know. But we just trusted that there had to be ski slope there, you know. And so we said a prayer, sang the song, "We Shall Assemble on the Mountain," because we felt it was appropriate. And we jumped on our sleds, and we just took off. I mean, took off flying, and we got to the lit part going down through, and it was kind of, you know, it was kind of leveled out. Well, all of a sudden, that thing dropped, and it dropped drastically, and we went, I mean, I'm going flying down through there. I can't hear anything, but, you know, I'm kind of in a luge, you know. I'm like laying down this thing, looking between my feet. I got goggles on. Snow's hit me in the face. I'm licking my mouth off, you know. I'm just flying down through this thing. Well, you come down through there, and as it kind of, there's the moon is kind of lighting it down there, and you can see there's a big, huge patch of trees.
And we had to, we realized real quickly that we need to stop right there, scoot over a little bit, and then start going again because the slope came down. There was no turning this thing, you know. So we're going down this hill. We had to stop. We had to scoot over because the slope kind of took a turn and then back down. So we all got down there and we stopped and we were like, man, that is awesome. This is the coolest thing we've ever done. So we scoot over a little bit. We look down. We're like, see you at the bottom. And here we go, taking off. We're going flying down this mountain and we hit the Mogul Field. A Mogul Field, if you know what that is. That's where there's a bunch of little humps. This is what it sounded like. You know, it's just like you're boom, 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 all the way down there, shaking me to death. Anyway, we get down to the bottom of this thing. It took a while to get down there. Absolute blast. Some of the most fun I've ever had in my life. We're like, we got to do this again. This got to happen again. So we get on in the van. We drive all the way back up. We get the other van, driven both back down. Somebody had to stay at the van. We had a volunteer do that. Drive all the way back up, go back across. Well, this time I was thinking, okay, I've done this before, and I am really, really... I'm going all out this time. I mean, I was really laying back into this, but I decided this time I was going with all I had. So we said our prayer again. We forewent the We Shall Assemble, that song, that time we'd already done it. But we you know, I don't know why we were praying. This was illegal. But anyway, we were heading off down this mountain, and right as we flipped down, I mean, I'm heading off down through there. One of the guys had started before me. He was much bigger than me, so he had a little bit more weight, not fair. But he was heading down through there, and I could see him down there. And I'm thinking, you know what? I'm going to hang on as long as I can right here. I mean, this is a blast. This is so much fun. And I'm sitting, I'm approaching this patch of trees. I'm getting pelted in the face, and I'm trying as hard as I can every now and then to wipe it off the seat. And I'm heading towards this patch of trees. I'm thinking, hang in, just a little longer, just a little longer. Well, all of a sudden, I start noticing this sign. It's a big pole right in the middle of the trees. I didn't notice it the first time down. But as I'm hanging on, trying to go a little further, this sign said, beware of hole. And so I'm thinking, time for me to get off this. So the only way to stop yourself, by the way, was to roll off of this sled, okay? You dug your feet in, you dug your knees in, you dug your elbows in, you dug your fingers in, you dug your face in, you dug everything you could in, because you're flying down this hill, your sled's attached to you, and it's just kind of doing like this behind you. And so I waited till the last possible minute. I rolled off this thing. I dug my feet in, I dug my knees in, my elbows, my fingers, my face. I'm doing everything I can to slow down, and I am not slowing down. I'm heading straight towards this sign. Well, in my mind, why in the world is there a big hole out in the middle of ice, you know, in the middle of snow? In my mind, that means there's some sort of running water under this. I am scared to death at this point because I'm flying down this mountain feet first. I've hung on too long. I had this point where I could have gotten off or stayed on. I had to make a decision. I decided to stay on longer than I should have. I roll off this thing. I'm hitting ice. It's hurting. The fun is gone. I'm past the point that I should have done something. I've made a mistake here. And so as I'm flying down, I reach out and I start coming into these trees. And there's a limb hanging down. And I reach out and I grab the limb, and the limb just slips right off my hand. All the pine needles go flying off of it. My friend dives for my arm, grabs my arm, and right as he gets me, my hand just pulls right out of his hand. I go flying past the pole holding the sign that says, beware of the hole, and I reach out and I grab this pole, and it just goes doing and vibrating me off of it, and I go flying off into this hole feet first. I'm expecting fully to go in the water, under the ice, and die. I mean, that's pretty much what I think is about to happen, because I don't know how deep the water is. I'm thinking there's a hole there. It's going to have water in it. All these things going through my mind. And so as my feet go in this thing, I turn and I go, and I hold my nose and I go in. And I just hit the ground. And the sled just comes plowing just all around, just banging off the walls of this thing. And I look down and there's this little trickle of water going right between my feet. And I did not cause that, by the way. But there was a little trickle of water right between my feet. And I looked down, I looked up, and I was in about a 6.5-7 foot hole. And I had made a mistake. And all my friends come down, they're looking at me, and I'm 5'6". I'm sitting here going, what am I doing here? How did I get right here? How did I get in this position? I had a chance to pass this up, but I missed that chance. I had a decision. I had to make a decision. I made the wrong decision. I should have jumped off. I should have not stayed on. I knew what was going on. I knew I could see what was coming, but I hung on too long. My friends made like a little, grabbed one of them's feet, and they grabbed me and pulled me up out of there. And the thing was, I was scared to death, but I still had to sled down the rest of the mountain. So I thought, well, I almost died. I escaped it once. Let's go on. So we scoot over, and here we are, taking off again. You know, I think in our lives, a lot of times we find ourselves in that position. Not necessarily where we're wondering whether or not we're going to hang on to the sled, but we're wondering, where's this thing leading us? Where am I going? You know, if I hang on to this, am I going in the right direction? I come and I've got a decision to make. Or maybe there's a decision that's already made for me. I am going into the next stage of my life, and I don't know where it's leading me. I don't know what to do. And we begin questioning ourselves at that point. Have I done the right thing? Have I hung on too long? Should I have turned somewhere else? How have I gotten to this place? A lot of the times we can't control the decisions that we find ourselves in. The places that we find ourselves in our lives. I mean, you're going to age, you're going to get older, you're going to change, you're gonna mature, you're gonna have to move along with your life. And there's nothing we can do about that. But it's at those crossroads in our lives that we really have to stop for a second and say, who am I, what do I want, and where am I going? Do I need to hang on? Do I need to let go? Do I need to turn one way to the other side? What do I need to do? Which way do I need to go right here? And a lot of those times, they seem fun. They seem exciting. They seem new. But at the same time, there's a part of us that just scared to death because we have no idea what's coming. Some things we can see warning signs for, some things we can't. But either way, here we go, because we've come along this far, and we are moving. Our life is moving on. Maybe you find yourself like Moses, a good man who found himself in a tough position, and he ran. And you can understand why. He was pulled from both sides. They were his people, and then they were his people. They were the Egyptians, and they were the Hebrews. He didn't know exactly what to do. He didn't know exactly what he should do, so he ran. And now he's out here for 40 years feeding sheep out here. And there's a burning bush, and he comes to it, and he hears a voice out of it. And this voice tells him to do something. He didn't ask for that thing. He didn't ask for that. He did not ask for God to set this thing on fire and it not burn. And he didn't ask for God to come talk to him. But all of a sudden he finds himself in that place and he's got to make a decision. Am I going this way or am I going that way? Maybe you're like Jonah and you find yourself in times where God says, and you know what's right. God's not going to speak to you and tell you exactly what to do, but you know what's right and you know what's wrong. You know what God wants you to do and you know what you want to do. And you've got to make a decision. And there's an interesting verse in Jonah chapter 1 that I've always stood out to me. Because the verse says, and he paid the fare. The reason that's interesting to me is because I see Jonah standing in a line for a ticket. And my assumption is if you're down at the harbor, that there's probably one line and you go up there and tell them, kind of like a movie theater. You walk up and you say, I want a ticket to this one. I want a ticket to this one. I want a ticket to that one. And he's standing there in line. He's moving along. He's a good man. He knows what's right. He knows what's wrong. But he's battled. He's conflicted in his mind. He steps forward, and all of a sudden, it's his turn to make a decision. He says, I will take a ticket to Tarshish. He paid the fare. Up until that point, it was wide open. He still could have done what God wanted him to, or he could have turned the other way, and he chose. He paid the fare. He pulled his money out. He put himself, and he in a situation where he was going to fail. Maybe we find ourselves in those crossroads in our lives where it's a game time decision. We know what we should do. We know what we want to do. We know what we don't want to do. We think we know what the outcome's going to be. And we pay the fare. And sometimes it's for the right direction and sometimes it's for the wrong. You know, maybe we find ourselves like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I would say you're probably a whole lot more like those folks. You love God. You know what's right. You know what's wrong. you know that no matter what, you're going to be faithful. And there's a crossroad, and there's a decision to be made, and you don't even hesitate. I want you to notice, if you go through that, there's no discussion. They don't get in a big circle. You know, they're fixing to be thrown into a fiery furnace because they refused to bow to this huge image out in the middle of this plain when they heard that song that was sung. Nebuchadnezzar gave them every way to get out of that. Every way to avoid this, what he considered certain death. And there's no, they don't go, well, give us just a minute. We'll come back. And we don't read where they collaborate. They just turn around and look at him and say, we're not bowing to your image. God's going to save us, and even if he doesn't, we're still not bowing to your image. I mean, that's probably the way most of you are. You're probably the kind of people, because you're here tonight, I think we beat up on y'all too much. You're good people with good hearts. You want to go to heaven. You want to do the right thing. You make mistakes. But when it comes to the big decisions in your life, you're probably going to make the right decision. But sometimes I think we find ourselves in a situation like the man in Mark chapter 9. His son has this demon, something we don't even really understand. And this demon has tried to kill his son. And don't think for a second that that father has not tried everything under this son to get rid of that demon. He's talked to every doctor he can talk to. He's read every book he can read. He's gone every place he could go. He's taken his son everywhere because that's his little boy. And his little boy keeps throwing in the fire and in the water. It's awful. Every time he feels helpless. He feels helpless. He doesn't know what to do. He wants to follow God. He wants to be the right kind of person. He believes in Jesus. So he heard about Jesus coming into town. He goes to him. And before he gets to Jesus, there's Jesus' disciples there. And he says, I need y'all to cast this demon out of my son. I've done everything. And they try, and nothing happens. And they try again, nothing happens. Finally, Jesus comes walking by, and what does that man say? And this is where a lot of us find ourselves. Words that, ever since I understood what they meant, have haunted my soul, really. Because they characterize so much of our lives. He said, I believe. Help my unbelief. Sounds like an oxymoron, kind of like jumbo shrimp, you know, or as Lonnie would say, Tennessee football, you know. It doesn't seem like a girl that's pretty ugly, you know. It just doesn't work right, you know. I believe, help my unbelief. How does that work? If you think about it, you think about your own lives, you know exactly what that man was saying. I have faith, but it's not strong enough. I want to do the right thing, but I don't always do it. I want to be the right kind of person, but I'm not always that kind of person. A lot of us find ourselves like that. And so I want us to turn to the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews, once you understand the background of that book, opens up Christianity wider than it's ever been opened for you. At least it has for me. I've fallen in love with the book of Hebrews because at first it seems confusing. It's got mystery surrounding it from its very beginning. We don't even know who wrote this book. We got some idea. Some have even said that it wasn't written, that it was actually a speech, and somebody copied it down because it kind of flows like a speech would flow. They've got all kinds of different ideas of who wrote this thing based on the way this was said or the way that was said. The reality is we don't know, and so you walk into the book and there's mystery surrounding it, but there are things that we do know about the book. And we know who it was written to. It was written to the Jews who lived in and around Jerusalem. Now, what did that mean? That meant that these were the folks who stayed there after they were baptized. Some of these folks might have been baptized in Acts chapter 2 and never went home. Maybe it was that these people were Jews in this area and they were baptized either in Acts 2 or some other time after that, and they stayed around. And things were different. Their families didn't respond to them like they used to respond to them. They had to completely change where and how they worshiped. Everything that they'd ever known for their whole lives had to completely change because everything they'd ever known had been based on the Old Testament. And now all of a sudden they're just supposed to get rid of all that and live under these guidelines and these new rules. And it was confusing for them. And some have suggested that a large number of this crowd, this audience that this book would have been written to, would have been much like you, and they were second generation Christians, meaning their parents might have been baptized in Acts chapter 2 or shortly thereafter. And now they have come along and grown up. And their faith's kind of been handed to them. And as you read through the book, what you see is this. They're in and around Jerusalem, and the Jewish faith has continued and remained strong, and Jesus has not come back yet. You know, their assumption was that if they became Christians, that somehow the Jewish faith would be done away with. That if they became Christians, that Jesus would come back and get them soon. I mean, the Thessalonians, he had to write back and tell them, start working again. The main understanding of that is that they believed so much that Jesus would come back today, they quit going to work. They believed that Jesus would have come back today. So why would I get up and work? I'm just going to stay on the front porch and look for him. That's the reason he says, you got to get back to work. I don't want you to be ignorant concerning the second coming. So he explains to them, you're not going to know when it's going to happen, but let me show you exactly what it's going to sound like. Doesn't say anything about what it's going to look like, but what it's going to sound like. You're going to know it. You're not going to know when, but you're going to know it. And so these folks that the book of Hebrews is written to, they're at a crossroads in their lives. They're wondering whether or not they should remain Christians. Jesus hasn't come back. We expected him to come back. He's not come back yet. It's been weeks. It's been months. It's been years. And Jesus hasn't come back yet. We haven't even heard anything from him. He was here, then he was gone. We heard that he ascended into heaven. Was that true? Did that really happen? Or did they make that up and try to fool me with this? They would sit there and they'd say, I know one thing for sure. The Jewish faith is continuing. And they're doing pretty good. And so the Hebrew writer starts off that book and says, God has spoken in times past to men many different ways. But today, he chooses to speak to us through his son. You can go through John chapter 4, 14, 15, and 16, and Acts chapter 1, and Acts chapter 2, and Ephesians chapter 4, and kind of show how that works. The idea was that Jesus was going to send the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit would inspire men to write what we have, and that's how Jesus speaks to us today. But he goes through and he gives Jesus strong accolades in the first chapter. And the first thing he does is he starts comparing him to angels. Why would he compare him to angels? Well, first of all, you find in chapter 2, verse 2 of the book of Hebrews that they respected angels because the word of the Lord came from angels. When you go back and look at the Old Testament, you'll see that when an angel comes, something really awesome was about to happen. Good or bad, it was going to be awesome. And so they had a deep respect for angels. And so he says, listen, I want you to know, you have a respect for angels, but Jesus is better than your angels are. And then he's going to go in chapter 2 and go, but he made himself a little lower than the angels. He allowed himself to be made lower than the angels to be like you. And in chapter 3, he's going to say, but don't think that he is like you in that he can sin like you and he understands the way you do. Because he then compares him to the best man they've ever known, Moses, and says he's better than Moses was. And then in chapter 4, he's going to compare the rest that Joshua talked about to the rest that Jesus offers. And then in chapter 5, he's going to start talking about this high priest. He's going to start working on what they're seeing over here. They see the temple. They see the believers going in and out. They see those folks going over and over and over, doing the same things over and over and over, year in, year out, week in, week out, day in, day out. They hear the animals being sacrificed. They see all the things that are going on. And there's a high priest standing over there. And he says, you know that high priest over there? Let me tell you what. Jesus is more important than that high priest. And let me tell you why. Because he understands you. He understands you because he wanted to understand you. And so in chapter 5, 6, and 7, he's going to talk about that high priest. And then in chapter 8, he's going to say, but they're under an old covenant. You're under a brand new one. So now he's compared them to angels. He's compared them to men. He's compared what he offers to what the Old Testament offers. He talks about the high priest as opposed to Jesus being the high priest. which doesn't mean a whole lot to us because we don't understand it, but we get concepts out of it. And then he says, they're under a covenant, and it's not near as good as yours. The blood of those bulls and goats that you hear over there being slaughtered cannot take away your sins. You're under a better covenant with better promises. It has a better hope. And then he's going to get a little more specific. And he's going to talk about the sacrifice. Those sacrifices can't do anything, but the sacrifice of Jesus can take away everybody's sins. And then he's going to move into chapter 11, what we call Faith's Hall of Fame. And if you just look at that from a helicopter view, you kind of see that he's wanting to talk about faith. Okay, we got Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Faith is substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Verse 6, without faith it's impossible to please God. Okay, we got all that. And we're talking about faith. But if you look at that in the grand scheme of the book, let me tell you what the problem is. I believe these folks didn't feel like the Old Testament belonged to them. I believe that they didn't feel like they were part of that lineage. If you look at the grand scheme of that book, it's like it seems like they had all these patriarchs, all these great people in the past. They had learned about all their lives. They had heard about Adam. They'd heard about Noah. They'd heard about Moses. They'd heard about Abraham. They'd heard about David. They'd heard about all these people in the Old Testament. And then in their minds, I do believe if you look at it as a whole, they felt like when Jesus came and they accepted him as the Son of God and were baptized and added to the church, that they veered off and started a whole new lineage. And that the Jews who still stayed over there, that they claim that Old Testament as their lineage. But what the Hebrew writer is trying to say is you're all wrong. Adam is yours. David is yours. Moses is yours. Noah is yours. Maybe it was their preachers were afraid to talk about the Old Testament because they didn't want to confuse people with making them think that we were, you know, whatever the case is. He said, you are the continuation of the lineage from Adam. They are the ones who have gone off. These folks were at a crossroad. Do I believe in Jesus? Do I not believe in Jesus? Do I continue in Christianity? Do I not continue in Christianity? Let me ask you something. Have you ever wondered if all this was right? Have you ever wondered if God is real? Have you ever wondered if we're doing it the right way? Have you ever wondered if we've missed something or we've overlooked something or we've made something up? Have you ever wondered that? I have wondered that before. Sometimes we find ourselves at crossroads. And the book of Hebrews gives us a little insight to how we ought to deal with that. Hebrews chapter 2. He's just finished comparing Jesus to the angels. He says in verse 1, therefore we must give the more earnest heed to the things we've heard, lest we drift away. You're at a crossroads. You don't know whether or not you should believe in Jesus or go back to the Old Testament style of worship since it's continued and going so strong over there. Maybe that's not your problem. Maybe you're wondering whether or not you should follow what you know to be right. Maybe you've got a right or wrong decision and you've always done the right thing. You're the kind of person who've always made the right decisions. And now you have a right or wrong decision to make. You're at a crossroad like Jonah was. You know what you should do, but you know what you want to do. The Hebrew writer says, remember what you know. I had a math teacher who used to always tell us, go with what you know. When you're sitting here working through a problem, an algebra teacher, when you're working through a problem, stop and go with what you know is what she always said. That's what the Hebrew writer's saying. Don't forget what you know. Sometimes when people question what they're doing and why they're doing it, they want to just take everything they've ever known and throw it over their shoulder and just completely forget it. That's not fair. That's not a fair analysis. It's not a fair evaluation of anything. If you're at a crossroads and you know certain things and you don't know other things, why would you discredit everything you've ever known? So many people want to do that. I know people who question whether or not there's a God, and they take everything they've ever known in their life and they say, none of that matters anymore because I question God. How can that possibly be? If there's certain things that you know, certain things that you've been told, certain things you've been taught, certain things that have been proven to you, we can't discredit those things. And so when you're at a crossroad in your life and you don't know exactly what to do, you got to go with what you know. I remember when I was in high school, I was 14. I was on a baseball team. We were awesome. We were the all-star team from Kingston, Tennessee, the Kingston Yellow Jackets. We were a great baseball team. We were slated to win the state tournament. I mean, we were tremendous. Every position had a phenomenal baseball player at it. And all of our backups were good. And we just breezed through the first tournament. Whipped everybody. Nobody even came close to us. We run-ruled a couple teams. We moved right through the regionals. Nothing. We hadn't lost a game yet. We've gone through two tournaments and nobody's even come close to us. Our pitchers are shutting them down. We're hammering the ball. We're making very few mistakes in the field. I mean, we were tearing them up. We go to the sub-state tournament in Nashville, Tennessee, and our parents already go ahead and get hotel rooms for the whole thing because they just expect that we're going to win the whole thing. Well, we got down there and we got a little cocky and we couldn't hit the ball. And we missed a couple of grounders, and there was a pop fly that got over somebody's head. And the next thing you know, we lost our very first game in that sub-state tournament. We hadn't heard that that was an option. We were supposed to beat everybody. We were supposed to take everybody out. This was our tournament. All we really had to do was show up and play, and they were going to give us the trophy. That's kind of the way we thought it was going to be. So all of a sudden, we're in the loser's bracket, and we got to play again this afternoon? We hadn't had to do that before. We were winning everything. We waited till tomorrow. We showed up. We killed a team. We played the next day. We won the tournament. That's what we were supposed to do. That's not what happened. We went into that loser's bracket and got beat the first game. Double elimination. We're out. Done. Our coaches were some college guys who weren't the most moral of people. They weren't the most upstanding folks. And what they did was they told all the parents, listen, maybe we can work out a deal where we can get some of these rooms taken off and y'all can go on back home and we'll stay around with the boys with the other rooms that they won't let us have. And the hotel worked out a deal where they let us take like a certain number of rooms off. They said, since you booked so many, you're going to have to at least keep these three or four. And so all the parents went home, except for just maybe a one or two families. And they stayed in a room over here. And the coach calls a team meeting at midnight. And he calls us all into the room, and he closed the door, and he said, fellas, you've worked hard. And he flips over, open a cooler, and it's full of beer. We're 14. It's full of beer. And he takes a couple cartons of cigarettes and throws on the bed, and he goes, I won't tell anybody. I got a crossroad here. I'm a good guy. I know what's right and I know what's wrong. I'm at a crossroad. But I already mentioned to you, I know what's right and I know what's wrong. And so I raised my hand. They already called me church boy because I had to miss a week of practice every year because I went to church camp. And the only thing that would happen to me is I didn't get to start the very first game of the first tournament. They'd put me in about the third inning. I'd start the rest of it, so I was fine with that. It was a good trade-off for me to go to camp. And the joke was, there's church boy. And I raised my hand. He goes, oh, sorry, Reed, you may leave. I said, thank you. And I stood up and I walked to the door and I reached and grabbed it and I opened it. I opened the door and as I walked through it, I reached and grabbed it and I was pulling it stopped. I couldn't get to close and I turned around. There was a line of my two teammates standing right behind me. We all walked out and went to another room. They said, thank you for doing that. I would have never done that. Now, I've made mistakes in my life, but I know what's right and I know what's wrong. And some decisions, some crossroads are not near as hard. Some decisions are not near as hard as we make them. The Hebrew writer says, remember what you know. When you're questioning this, remember what you know. This isn't difficult. You know right. You know wrong. You know what you should do. You know what you shouldn't do. Allow that to be part of your decision-making process when you're at these tough times. The second thing I want to mention is in chapter 4. You go to chapter 4. And he's talking about the rest. He compares the rest that Joshua mentions to the rest that Jesus offered. And in verse 11 he says, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall after the same example of disobedience. What I want you to think about is this. When you got these big times in your life, these crossroads, think past them. Think okay, right here it is. I'm at an intersection. There's right and there's wrong. There's a big decision to be made. There's something in front of me. I'm nervous. I don't know exactly what to do. I know what I know, and I remember what I know. Think past this decision. A man came to me one time. It was a good friend of mine's. It was a girl's in our youth group, and she had a good buddy of mine, and her daddy was a good man. He was a deacon in the church. He had a great life. He had this beautiful wife. He had this outdoorsman kind of son. Had this gorgeous daughter who could just sing like she's in the opera right now, actually. She's just phenomenal, working with some places in Nashville. He had this little picket fence around his house out in the back of nowhere. And there was a huge hill that went up the back. And when you go over the side of that, there was a big old creek that ran around it. He had goats back there. The man had goats, you know. Not many people have goats. The man had goats. He had it made. One day he walks into his wife. He walks in the door and he looks at her. Gorgeous, beautiful, sweet, great lady. And he says, "I love you, but I'm leaving you." He said, "I love you, but I'm leaving." He said, I found somebody else. She shows me attention that you don't show me. I'm leaving." And there was a huge fight. And there were all kinds of tears that were shed and things were said. She gladly helped him move his stuff out as she threw it out the windows and the doors. And he collected it, put it in his car, and drove across the county and went across the county line heading to the lady's house who had just left everything for. He pulls up in front of her house and he walks up to the door and he knocks on it. She opens the door and goes, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I did it." She said, "You did what?" He said, "I told my wife." She said, "You did what?" He said, "I couldn't do it anymore. I told my wife I want to be with you. And I left my family." He said, "You did what? What are you talking about? This was only for fun. This wasn't supposed to be like this. Get your stuff and go back to her and beg her to take you back. I don't want you. This is over." Well, he knew she wasn't going to take him back. Huge divorce, messy, nasty. I saw him at the wedding that I was conducting with his daughter. He walked up to me and I said, "How you doing?" Maybe 2 years had passed. He said, "I'm good." I said, "How are things?" He said, "Great, I'm about to get married." And I looked at him and I said, "Brother, I love you, and you know you cannot do that." He said to me, "Tell me that again." And I said, "You can't do that, and you know you can't do that. You cheated on your wife. You don't have the right to remarry." And he said, can we talk about that? Do you know that I have told numerous members of the church that I was getting remarried, and all they've said to me was congratulations? They were excited. Nobody had enough guts to tell me. Would you please talk to me about it?" And I said, "Absolutely." So the next day I was driving back to Texas, because that's where I lived at the time, and he called me and we talked and we walked through it. And he said, this is what he said. He said, "I'm at a bad place in my life. I made a decision that was wrong and it's led me down a path that's even more wrong." He said, "I'm miserable. I hate my life. I hate everything about it. I hate going home. I hate getting up. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I hate it. I'm miserable." He said, "I was never meant to be alone, and God does not want me to be unhappy." And I said, "One, if we're being honest, you put yourself in this position. I know that doesn't help, but it's true." And I said, "Two, God is a whole lot more concerned with your obedience than he is your happiness. He's a whole lot more concerned about you doing the right thing than you being happy. You know why? Because he knows what's in front of this. He knows what's past this." And I said to him, I said, "Listen to me, let me ask you a question. If you could go right now, if you could go back in time 6 years, 5 years, what would you tell yourself?" He said, "I tell myself, don't do it. Don't do it. It's going to be awful. It's going to be terrible." I said, "You would go back and tell yourself, don't do it." And he said, "Yes." I said, "Okay, now go forward a little bit. and you're at the day of judgment, standing before God, what would you come back and tell yourself now? And he said, don't do it. Sometimes we got to look past the decision. We got to look past what's there, what the cross, the different directions we have, the paths we have. We have to think past those. That's what the Hebrew writer was saying. Look past all this. You've got a problem. You're conflicted in your mind. Look past it. Look to the rest that's available. The rest that the Old Testament offer is temporary. The one that the New Testament offer, he was telling them, is permanent. It's forever. It's eternal. So maybe we need to look past them. The next thing I want to look at is in chapter 10, verse 29. Chapter 10, verse 29. I'm going a little over here. Excuse me. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 29. Really right before it is one of the scariest verses in the whole Bible to me. There are certain verses that scare me to death, and this is without a doubt one of them. In Hebrews chapter 10, verse 26 and 27, for if we sin willfully after we receive the knowledge of truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment and a fiery indignation which will devour the adversary. It says if we can do what's wrong once we know it's wrong, there no longer remains a sacrifice for that sin. Now understand, 1 John chapter 1 tells us that if we continue in the light as he is in the light. You know, David was one of the men who he clearly did things that were wrong. He did a lot, several things were wrong, did a lot of things that were right. He was called a man after God's own heart. The Bible tells us there was only one time that he actually left God, and that was when he sinned with Bathsheba. And so Christians are going to make mistakes, but the whole goal is not to say, well, I'm not perfect, so I can do whatever I want to, but to try as hard as we can to be perfect. That's the goal. At night when we say a prayer, we should be able to mention specifically every sin that we've committed that day and ask for forgiveness of it, because there's so few in our lives, and they're so glaring because of our hearts. But I want you to go on to verse 29. He says, oh, how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace. Let me tell you what he's saying right there. Don't be disrespectful to God or his Son. Listen, you may question God. You may wonder whether or not he's real. You may wonder whether or not what we're doing is right. You may wonder whether or not that book came from him. But if you remember what you know, and there is still hope for the future in you, don't be disrespectful in your questioning. Let me tell you what I mean by that. There's a difference in asking a question and questioning God. There's a difference in asking God a question and questioning God. And the difference is our attitude. This is what I want you to consider. If you're at a place in your life and you're having a hard time with the transition or what's going on, you don't know exactly which way to go. Consider the fact that God is real and that Jesus is his Son. And don't do anything at that cross place, at that decision-making, at that place where you've got to make it. Don't do anything that you will regret if you were right in the first place. That's what he's telling the Hebrews. That's what he's telling them. You're questioning whether or not Jesus is the Son of God. Well, wait just a second. Before you do that, assume that he is while you're doing your questioning, and don't do anything to insult him. Don't consider what he's done a common thing. The reason I say that is because a lot of doubt and a lot of regret comes from things we do at those crossroads. At those times when we don't really know what we're going to do and what we should do and what we shouldn't do. When we've got all these options and different decisions, we don't know exactly what all's going on. It's at that point in our lives that we do a lot of things that bring regret. Keep a level of respect for God and Jesus. No matter what decision you make, so that when you come back, if you just choose to make the wrong one, that you won't have so much to feel bad about. Don't get me wrong, one sin separates us from God. I understand that. But I'm talking about a lifestyle. And I'm talking about things that come from making wrong decisions. And you can make your own application of that. I want to go to heaven more than anything that I know. And I'm so grateful for books like the book of Hebrews. It tells me that Jesus came and lived on this earth so he could understand me. You have doubt in your mind? Don't think for a second Jesus didn't have doubt in his mind. That's the reason he came to this earth, so he could understand what it feels like. When you pray to God and you say, God, I have questions, I don't know what to do. Jesus stands there and goes, I know what that feels like. I stood out there in the middle of that desert, hungry and thirsty, and Satan came to me, and I was confused, and I understand what that means. He was tempted at all points like we are, yet without sin. You hurt because something bad happens in your life, and you pray to God, and Jesus says, I understand that. I had a friend named Lazarus, and I cried because I lost him. You got decisions to make. And you pray about those decisions, and Jesus stands right there and goes, I understand what that feels like. Because I lived like that person. And I understand what it's like to be confused. And I understand what it's like to feel betrayed. And I understand what it's like to not know exactly what to do. And I know what it's like to pray for something and not get the answer I want. And there's a benefit in that. If we could keep that in our minds, those times of crossings, and we pray to God, we can have full confidence that there's somebody standing there, our high priest, who says, I know what that feels like. Sometimes if we have somebody on our side, those times of confusion aren't near as confusing as we thought they were. You know, we got to remember what we know. Sometimes we got to look past those crossroads. We got to figure out a way not to be disrespectful when we're making our decisions. We got to understand that Jesus understands. He understands because he wanted to understand. That's why he came. Some of you may not be at those places in your life. I would assume that most people in this room are doing really good. And we appreciate you because the church needs more people who are doing really good. But during those times, and if there ever comes one in your life, I hope that you look back at the book of Hebrews, consider the context and read through it and understand that Jesus is better than anything that the Old Testament or this world has to offer. Jesus is always better. And that's what the Hebrew writer wanted those folks to know in their crossroad. Would you bow with me? Father, we love you and want to be with you. We're thankful for this opportunity to be here tonight. We're grateful for the souls and the hearts of the people who are here. Help us, Father, to want to be more like you. And in those times where we question, and in those times when we doubt, and in those times we don't know exactly what's going to happen, we don't know exactly what to do, we pray, Father, that you would help us, that you'd be with us, and that we can gain benefit from the fact that you chose to live on this earth through your Son so that he can stand beside you when we pray, understanding what it is that we're going through. Thank you for that, Father. Please be with us and help us, and be with us as we go through the rest of this night. Thank you for the food we're about to eat, and thank you for all those who have put this together. Help us and be with us. In your Son's name we pray.